Hi, it's Dan here for Dusty Discs Radio, and this is the podcast Liner Notes, revealing chats with Canada's retro music makers. Today, I'm very honored to have as my special guest singer, songwriter, musician, composer, Jimmy Bertucci, best known as the founding member, bassist, and songwriter for the 1970s pop rock band Abraham's Children. We'll be talking about his many musical adventures, and we'll get some insights into the Canadian music scene from someone who was an integral part of it from the late 60s, well into the 70s, and till to this day. So thanks for joining me today, Jimmy. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you, Dan.
Well, great. Well, thanks for coming on. I appreciate it. We're trying to make a historical record of many of the bands that were significant back then and kind of track your story and the experiences you had back then and up to today. And it's been a real fun adventure for me. And one of the things I get to do is revisit some of the catalogs and stuff. And I went through the Abraham's Children stuff and really, really enjoyed it, all the stuff I read and listened to. So kudos to you.
Great. Well, that's good to hear.
Yeah. So you were you go by Jimmy B, but you were born in Italy, so you're a true Italian that came to Canada.
True Italian, yes. actually, for anybody that's interested, my name is Vincenzo.
Okay.
So I know it's a mouthful. That's yes. Why I actually, it was a friend of mine that his name was Jim Brown.
Okay.
And he used to be the trainer or the supervisor at the park, where Harvard Park, where I grew up and lived. And he asked me what my name was, and I said, "It's Vincenzo." He goes, "Oh, whoa! How about we call you Jimmy?" That was his name.
Really?
I said, "Jimmy." You know, I was just off, just landed on in Canada or something.
Wow.
I said, Jimmy, yeah, that sounds good. So I went home. My mom called me, Vincenzo, go wash up for dinner. I said, "No, Ma, I'm Jimmy."
Oh, wow. And it stuck. She accepted that okay?
Oh, yeah. Wow. Are you kidding? They bought me my first Hofner Beetle bass.
That's funny. Well, that's cool. Yeah. So you were young when you came to Canada, but did you speak English at all, or did you have to learn?
No, I had to learn.
Okay.
I think I was about six.
Yeah.
And it didn't take long to learn, though.
No, I mean, you know. Yeah, yeah, fair enough. And you have no accent. Yeah. I mean, you grew up in Canadian school, right? So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, very good. So with the music, did you have formal training or did you just have like family influence and what was the deal there? How did you get started in that?
How did I get started? Well, actually my parents were very involved in my musical career.
Nice.
We took a walk down on College Street, and for anybody that's familiar with College Street, it's the Italian district, or it used to be the Italian district, right?
Yeah.
And we went by this music store, and I looked in the window, and there was this beautiful Beetle bass sitting there.
Yeah.
And I went, "Wow." And my mom said, "Let's go in and see it." I said, "Okay." So I went in, and the owner of the store, his name was Giulio, came over and said, "Ah, little Vincenzo, how are you?" I said, "I'm great." He says, "Do you like the guitar?" I said, "Yeah, it's really nice." He goes, "It's yours." He had ordered it for me.
What? How did he know that? How did he know that?
My mom went in there and ordered it.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah.
And that for the listeners who don't know, the Hofner bass is the Beatle bass that Paul McCartney played in the early Beatles stuff, right?
And still playing it.
Yeah, there you go. Wasn't that special? So, did I read correctly that you won tickets to see the Beatles?
I did. On I believe it was Chum at the time.
Wow.
I won two Beatle tickets to see them at Maple Leaf Gardens, and I took my sister.
Wow.
With me, she was a lot younger than me, and it was quite a buzz. In fact, I had this girl that was in the back of me. And she kept pounding on my head because at that time at the gardens, they had seats put in, right?
Right.
And I said, "If you don't stop, I'm going to turn around. I'm going to smack you." Anyway.
So what was that experience
they
like? Lots of yelling.
Oh,
Awesome. Did they get to play? Because back then they had no monitors and the crowd was yelling so much you could hardly hear the band, right?
That's right. That's exactly right. Yes, they did. They ended up playing, you know, I forget. They probably did about half a dozen songs or something.
Wow.
And it was really funny because now when I look at that concert then, they were using columns. Do you know columns?
Absolutely.
Are?
Speaker columns, sure columns, and trainer columns.
That's what they were using.
Wow.
And, you know, now I think I would go, geez, in the gardens, you know, it was like awful.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Well, could you hear the band at all? I mean, was the crowd?
Yeah, you could actually hear the band. Yeah. I mean, you know, there was a lot of screaming going on and, you know, that was in the way. But no, you could actually hear the band, you know, it was pretty good.
Well, good for you. Well, to have the chance to see the Beatles. And of course, you know, you could never overstate the influence or the impact that would have had on you. Right. And you got into music heavily right after that, I would assume.
Yes, very, very much so. They were like, I don't know how to say it. They were just, you know, they were just perfect as a band. And, you know, I remember after a while, after listening to the songs and when I was on my way home, I was going, they were great songs.
Yeah.
They were
definitely
really great songs and they really made an impact on me. Yeah. And, you know, and I think I just went home and I decided to start writing.
Yeah. No, good for you. Well, I have to say that, you know, the Beatles, that the melodies that they wrote and the people that were influenced by the Beatles, that's the one significant thing that I think came from that is that they tried to write good melodies. And I think that would be in your case as well with some of the Abraham's Children music and stuff. Their melodies and harmonies and their Beatle influence, but not Beatles, if you can.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and it made everyone sing better and play better and write better melodies. I think that's what's missing if I were to, you know, say something about modern music. The melodies aren't as strong as what the Beatles and the Beatles influenced bands put out. I think that's a fair statement from my perspective, I think.
Very, very true. Yeah, it is. It's a good perspective because, you know, I think, even the Beatles themselves probably didn't realize the impact they were having at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, they were probably, I mean, enjoying it. You could see they were having a good time because, you know, they had this perpetual smile on their face at the gardens, you know, so it was interesting. It was very interesting.
But the frenzy must have been just unbelievable. Like everywhere, your life's coming at you at 100 miles an hour for those guys. I mean,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, it was pretty hectic. Well, actually, you know, it's not too bad. We had that kind of experience at a place in Hamilton.
Yeah.
A place called Iverwind Stadium.
Okay, yeah, I was born in Guelph, so I'm right from that area originally. Anyway,
Well, we were scheduled to play there, and I remember, it's very big, but we were on stage. We started playing. I think we started playing "Goodbye Farewell." That was the song we started because you know it was the bass starting and.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, the crowd just came at the stage.
Oh, wow.
And you know, our manager's going, let's get out of here. Come on, let's go, guys. So we got in. We actually got in the car. They jumped on stage and started taking the equipment.
Wow.
Oh, it was just amazing. And we got in the limo and then, you know, we took off and we didn't even go back to play.
Wow. Jeez.
Yeah.
Did you manage to get some of your stuff back or was it all trashed?
No. A lot of it was trashed. There was a couple of cymbals missing, you know, but most of the stuff was still okay, but it was just an experience.
Wow. Well, yeah, you got to experience a little bit of what the Beatles went through. I think they had to get helicoptered out of a gig. Wasn't that in Vancouver where the crowd rushed so much they took a helicopter to get them out?
God.
Crazy.
So that was a good thrill.
Yeah, no, good for you. So what happened in your journey? Like, did you have a defining moment, or how much of what you did was planned, or just sort of happenstance and accident?
Are you talking about
I mean, for your career, like, you know, you decide you want to play music and then you go, okay, was there sort of a moment when you said, okay, I'm going to make something out of myself. I'm going to go and be a musician, a professional musician. And then what plan did you have? Like, did you just kind of think, well, we'll see what happens?
No, we actually had, you know, we had a little bit of structure. I wasn't really thrilled with our manager. Okay. I have to admit that, you know.
Yeah.
Which was the same manager that managed Teenage Head. I don't know if you're familiar
yeah,
with.
Of course, yeah.
Teenage. Yeah, okay. Yeah, you know what? I think as we grew as a band, you know, my partner at the time, Ronnie, the guitar player, we started writing a little bit more progressively. So it was like, you know, we were noted as a bubblegum band.
Okay, because of Hot Love, that came out, that was in the late 60s, right?
Right. Because of Hot Love and Goodbye Farewell, which was a follow-up to it, which was, you know, became a monster hit
great
for
us. Great songs, great songs.
And then Gypsy and Thank You.
Yeah.
So when these songs, you know, and I was getting tired of it.
Right.
And I told him that, too. I said, you know, we've got to, maybe we could write, you know, it was at the time of, like, Yes was around, and you know, and I thought it'd be really good to be able to sort of write like that.
Yeah.
And anyway, it did cause a bit of friction in the band.
Okay.
And you know, that was my decision that came to sort of take a different avenue.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting because, you know, a song like Hot Love, which was a big hit. I remember that well. And it was just a great song that people really related to. So that kind of, I guess, pigeonhole might not be the right word, but you get known as that kind of a band, right? That's your big signature song.
Yeah.
I guess that was the first one, right? The first one that really
put
you on the map. And then, so that kind of, I guess the record people and stuff are going, well, this is what we want. This is the kind of band you are. So they kind of put you into that. But I mean, that's not bad. What the heck? I mean, it's a great song. You got songs on the radio and you're doing what you thought you wanted to do, right?
Oh, yeah. 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 There's no doubt. I mean, you know, I think as far as a band, I mean, I think we were a fun band. Yeah. We weren't, you know, we weren't looking for, I'd say we weren't looking for our fame or anything like that. We were out there and we were playing. We played a lot. God, we played a lot.
Very good for you. Yeah.
From British Columbia to the East Coast and the United States. I mean, we did a lot of touring. We did a lot of touring. I don't think people realize that.
Yeah.
I think they just thought maybe the band was just like a recording band or something, but they never, you know, we did a lot of playing.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah, you're out there working the product and stuff too. And then, like to your earlier point, though, I mean, you're not trying to be Pink Floyd. You're not trying to be Yes, right? You're doing pop tunes and fun music.
Yeah,
is what I sense, right?
So, yeah.
So I have to ask, how did the name Abraham's Children emerge? Because that's obviously the biblical reference and stuff. But I was curious about that.
Well, it's funny because we were touring and we got a letter from New York and this is before we were called Abraham's Children.
Yeah.
We were called Captain Midnight's Dirty Feet.
Yeah. There you go. I got that here. Yeah.
Yeah. And, so we got a letter from the owners of Captain Midnight, which was, what do you call it? I guess he was a hero, you know, a superhero.
Okay.
So we got this letter and it said, refrain from using the name Captain Midnight. We couldn't figure it out, but it was just at the time that they were releasing the album. And, you know, we said, oh, well, you know, we're going to get sued.
Yeah.
So we better change the name. And the owner of the company was an old man named Abraham.
Oh, okay.
Now, if you're familiar, he was Gary Salter's father.
Okay.
Gary was the president of the record label that we were signed to.
Okay.
And so he said, why don't you call it Abe's Kids? I said, what? What are you guys? You know, we kind of, you know, were tossing it around and saying, getting ready to release this damn album. And I said, why don't we go with Abraham's Children?
Right. Okay.
And they said, yeah, okay, let's do that.
Well, thanks.
And
for
that was it.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that, because I mean, the band name is just a handle, right? You got, when I first heard of the Goo Goo Dolls, I thought the Goo Goo Dolls, that's just too weird.
Yeah.
But then once you hear their songs and stuff, but I wanted to ask about it because obviously there's an Old Testament reference there with the children of Abraham and Isaac and Ishmael and stuff. So I wondered if there was any connection there, and it seems like there wasn't. It was just a different.
No, It was kind of a joke, actually.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's
because, you know, Abe was like, he must have been 80 at the time.
There you go.
And he goes, you know, I really like you guys. I like you guys a lot.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't know. I don't know if you're familiar with Gary, his son.
I'm not.
Okay. Gary was actually quite a player in the industry as far as music. And, you know, he opened a bunch of clubs in Toronto. Anyway, he was really good. If I have to say, as a record company, you know, they gave us everything that we wanted at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that was kind of interesting, you know.
Was that GAS Records, GAS Records?
Yes.
Okay, so.
Yeah. Gary Abe Salter.
Okay, there you go. Yeah, and that was your that was your first record deal, I guess, that you got, right?
It was, yes.
Yeah. Oh, good. And then, so, well, I read here that you, Jack Morrow saw you, and then Paul Gross from Phase One wanted to work with you. Well, that was pretty good break. I mean, you didn't plan that, right? You just went out and did your thing and then got noticed?
We were performing at this Jamaican club, actually, because we used to rehearse there, and for us rehearsing there, we played once a week for them. And they came in, him and Kathy Young, I think it was, came in and saw us play, you know, and he was overwhelmed. He just said, you know, you guys, what are you guys doing here?
Yeah.
Well, we said, you know, we're playing, we have to pay our bills, you know?
Yeah.
And, anyway, we signed with him and so on.
Yeah. And then the rest is history, as they say, 'cause you got a major studio at that point and you got some record company that's gonna, you know, you're gonna be their voice, right? And they're gonna push you and do what you need. And then you got a U.S. deal out of that too, is that right? Buddha Records.
Yes, we got. In fact, we charted with all three records. You know.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly, that was nice. Buddha, they came up from the States, and Gary had put on this show at the Inn on the Park, I think it was called. And it was he was showcasing his bands and his label. And we were playing there at the time. There was another band, I don't know if you're familiar with the band, called Rose.
I am not.
Oh, well, they became Hollywood Annie or something.
Okay.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, so that was one of the bands. Plus, he had a couple of other bands. So there were probably about 10 bands at the evening, and we were basically headlining the show.
Yeah.
And, you know, so Buddha was the one that actually a couple of companies were looking at us, and Buddha gave us the best deal. So
nice.
we went with Buddha.
So how much success did you have in the States, like for charting and touring? And
well, you know, it wasn't as consistent as we wanted it to be,
right.
But you know, we managed okay. You know, we played a lot, and it got us. It got us where we were at the time, and it was great. I mean, you know, we did. I think we broke the top 100 somewhere, and that was fine. It was good, you know. But you know, what can I say?
Well, it seems there's different levels. Like to be a stadium act in the States, you got to have several top 100 songs.
Yeah.
And then you can do an opening slots if you have maybe one or two. And then other than that, you're doing clubs and smaller venues, right?
Right. Well, you know, it was, we had a mixed kind of, our playing was, happened to be a mix. There were clubs that we had played, some really big clubs too.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was a place that we played once, and we never played clubs.
Hmm.
And this one club was called The Embassy. I don't know if you're familiar with The Embassy in Toronto.
No.
It was a huge place.
Hmm.
And it must have held at least 2,000 or 3,000 people in there.
Yeah.
Anyway, so we only ended up playing there because the owner of the club paid our price. And okay. And at the time it was pretty high
yeah.
too.
Yeah, well, you found your way, right? I mean, you must have felt like, okay, here's what we wanted. You got a record deal, you got a manager, you got radio play,
right.
You're touring. I mean, I guess it's coming at you really fast, but you're where you thought you wanted to be, right?
Yeah, definitely. We, you know, it was good times at the time. It was, you know,
absolutely.
Playing and touring.
Yeah. And you did some television shows too, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we did quite a few shows. I don't remember the names of them, but
Musical Friends and Canadian Bandstand.
Oh yeah, Musical Friends. Yeah. I remember that. They were in Montreal, I think.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. And what was it? Canadian Bandstand.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then there were a lot of shows. Actually, I think there's a couple of videos out there somewhere with us playing it. Well, at least I was playing at the time.
Yeah, no,
it's good. That's a long time ago, Dad.
Yeah, no, that's good though. I appreciate it because it's nostalgic. But I mean, it's 50 years ago. I get that, but it was such a magical time. I often talk about the golden age, 60s, 70s, and into the 80s was the golden age of sort of pop music, and you were right on the cusp of that, and right immersed in it. And it's just such a cool, you know, it's a life defining thing. Maybe you don't realize it at the time quite as much, but you look back and go, yeah,
that's true.
It's pretty cool, you know.
It is.
Yeah. So I have to ask you about the genres and the influences. Obviously, you were more of a pop, sort of pop rock, but I don't know how the record company would have categorized you, I guess mainstream or pop rock sort of thing.
Yeah.
And then you didn't give up your Italian roots because you had Italian influence, and then you ended up recording some Italian music and a version of some Italian, of some of your
Goodbye,
songs.
Goodbye, Farewell.
Yeah, that was, and so what's the name? Bye Bye Bambino.
Occhi Blu,
okay. And so how did that come about? What was the Italian connection? You wanted to get your roots?
It was really, it was kind of funny.
Yeah.
Gary, again, the owner of the record company, said, why don't you record this song, Goodbye Farewell, in Italian? And I looked at him and I went, are you nuts? And he goes, no, really. So he brought somebody in to help me rewrite the lyrics in Italian.
Yep.
And we decided, okay, well, we'll try it. The damn thing became a hit.
Crazy.
You know, it was just too much.
Yeah.
And but what happened was we had to play the song. I remember we opened for, what was his name? A guy named Little Tony. He was a really big star at the time.
Yeah.
And he was playing Maple Leaf Garden, so we were going to open for him, and we had the one song that was Italian, and that was it.
That's funny.
And the Maple Leaf Gardens was just filled with people but they were all Italian, and we walk on stage, and you know, and everything was basically English, but it was okay.
Okay.
It was a fun gig.
So, well, tell me about that. So did you record the Italian lyrics over the existing music, or did you re-record the whole song?
No, we just overdubbed the lyrics.
Okay, that makes sense, because the song's great, and it's cool. I love the bass and drums that come in, and you got the slide guitar solo, so you kept all that?
Yeah,
okay.
Everything was the same except the lyrics, and after a while, you know, We kind of like what we did is we did half English and half Italian.
Oh, good for you. Yeah.
Yeah. So
well,
we figured, there's got to be somebody there that's going to be, it's going to, you know, want Italian.
Well, it's kind of cool anyways, right? It's a different language, and Italians have a great affection for North America and vice versa. So there was no problem there. So did you get some pump in Europe? You got that became a big song in Europe, I guess, right?
Yeah.
And did you go over there and tour and play?
No, we didn't.
Oh, too bad.
We could have. We were asked a lot to come, but, you know, it just wasn't right at the time.
Okay. And of course, touring is expensive, the logistics and everything else. But
So
how successful was it in Europe? Was it a very well-known song in Italy or just Europe?
Actually, in Europe itself, it was, I remember it broke in Italy and then it started picking up other countries at the time.
Good.
It was trippy.
Yeah, no, that's good. Well, you always hope that the product will sell itself in some measure. If it's a good song, it's well recorded, and then you got the twist of the Italian lyrics and stuff. There's a lot of reasons to like it, right? So I have to ask you about Hot Love. So that came out, that was your first song we talked about, but it was re-recorded and re-released. Is that right? Was that within when you got the record deal?
Yeah, at the time it was. How can I put it?
So the one that became on the album, was that the original one that you recorded in, I guess it was 68, was it? Or what year did you record the first version of Hot Love?
I believe it was probably 69.
Okay. So is that the version that made it on the album?
Yes. Okay. Yes, it is.
Okay, I got you. Yeah. So why did it says here it was re-recorded, then re-released. Did you do another version of it?
I don't know why they did that.
Oh, okay.
I really don't. Yeah. I just remember the song. We did it and we showcased it actually at Center Island.
Yeah.
I think the album cover or the sleeve of the record is the island. I don't know if you have a copy of it or you
see
the copy.
I don't have one in front of me. No, I looked at the discography. I saw the picture, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that's, well, we played the island a few times, but the time we played it, we were Captain Midnight at the time.
Yeah.
And are you familiar with the island?
Not particularly. No, I came out to BC when I was young, so I didn't spend a lot of time in Toronto and Montreal and that area. So.
Well, the island was a great place, actually, for music.
Yeah.
There weren't a lot of outdoor avenues for bands at the time, but that was kind of a, you know, that we had some pretty good backup bands with us, I guess.
Very cool.
I can't remember, but there was all kinds of, you know, great musicians that played on there, and you know, we were just on the lineup with them.
Well, it was such a great time. I mean, I'm kind of lost in the 70s. People often ask online, what's your favorite decade? You know, and for me, it's the 70s. There was just such a buzz and the melt, you know, we talked about that.
Oh,
like, you know, and
incredible music.
It really, I mean, and natural, like, so for you guys, even in Hot Love, like I get the Crosby, Stills feel in there and the Beatles influence and the nice harmonies. And it's just beautiful, fun tune. I remember it well. So it was just such a magical time for music. And then, well, you guys did Gypsy. It was a great, really strong hook, very 70s sounding with a little bit of 60s flavor in there too. So the psychedelic flavor kind of spilled over a little bit into the 70s too, I guess, eh?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. It was a good time. I mean, the music was just so interesting. I mean, you know, I mean, there's some good music now too, but at that time, it was like every artist that I was listening to on the radio was amazing.
Yeah, yeah, I know, that's totally right. It's not an overstatement. I mean, everyone was trying to write good songs and sing well and play well. And then you experimented too. I mean, you got like in Thank You, you got the wah-wah, and then you brought strings. Strings are counterintuitive to a rock band, but they sure work when you bring the right people in, right? So whose idea was that? Was that the producer?
That was, it was actually, at the time, it was Paul's idea.
Okay.
We had another producer too, Alan Caddy.
Okay.
He was from England, and we got him in to come and produce, the songs there. And he was with a band too, a very famous English band. I can't remember the name of it, but, if you look him up, you'll see it. It's Alan Caddy. And I remember he said to us, we were young. He was a little older than us. And he said, you know, you guys are going to be very big. That's what he said. We said, oh, that's great. You know, we're like goofy kids, you know.
Yeah, right.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, that's right.
That's great.
You got to keep that in perspective, how young you guys were, and you're just kind of looking at everything going, okay. Then you stretched a little bit too, like in Rockin' in the City is a cool, it's almost an Outlaws kind of a feel, the double lead, the fast shuffle kind of, like you stretched a little bit to get away from the...
Well, we were starting, that's when we came to that point, you know, of saying we've got to change.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to do something that's going to, you know, get us away from this pop thing because, you know, you can only live... so long on pop songs.
Well, I guess, but
I know. Unless you're the Beatles, but
well, I mean, you certainly a good song is a good song. I mean, Goddess of Nature obviously, you know, I love that. That's great. The wah wah, and that's such a nice melody, and you got the smooth voice and the smooth vocals. I mean, it's very typical 70s pop rock, which is obviously what the record company wants, right?
Oh yeah. They did want that stuff.
So you nailed it with that one, and so that was with, again, you got strings in there, you got the producer, was that Paul Gross that you wrote that song with him, I guess, right?
Paul and I wrote that song, and actually Alan was a big influence on that too.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, because he did he was actually the one, him and Paul decided, you know, let's try the strings and see.
Yeah.
And I love them. I heard them, I said, yeah, definitely. This is where we want to go.
No, it works great. And it brings the mood, and there's just something about it. But again, it's counterintuitive for a rock band. But I guess you're trying different things and you want to get that magical sort of combination of sounds. And it certainly works.
Yeah.
No, that's great. So, yeah, you talked about your touring and how much you toured and all the dues that you paid. And of course, you know, you're right there living the dream. Did you reach the level of success that you had wanted?
Wow. That's a really good question. I think if you're happy at what you're doing, you've reached that level of success. Hmm. But, you know, we often have to think about the monetary value of, you make a lot of money on it? Well, I think I'm happy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think the other guys were too. It's hard to say. I mean, you can always be bigger, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I guess success is measured in many different ways too. Like, I like your point about being happy. I mean, if you certainly reached a higher level of success than most other people did, and there was 1,000 other bands that would taken your certainly level of success. But then some of the, I've talked to lots of guys who weren't happy in the end anyways, no matter how high they
went. That's true.
Right. And I'm
that's
thinking,
true.
Yeah. So that's part of it. But then I often ask, well, when you first started out, and if you just said, well, I want to be such and such, you know, what was that? I want to be, and then fill in the blank. Were you that? Did you get to be that?
Yes.
Yeah, which is great.
Of course.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. Because, you know, you have to sort of keep going.
Yeah.
And at least to a point of where you reach a certain amount of success.
Yeah.
And you know, you can talk about it till we're blue in the face, but you know, every band I know that was serious enough wanted the success as a rock band or as an entertainer or just a musician. I mean, you know, that's what you go for, but it doesn't mean you're always going to get it.
Well, in my case, I never took that ride. I know lots of guys, I've had lots of friends that did. I've been a full-time entertainer for over 40 years and made a good living, but I didn't pursue that end of it. But it's described, you know, you start out and you're hungry, and then you start climbing and you get to a certain, and then the wave crests, and then you stay plateaued for a bit, and then things happen, you know, like you left the band, or you lose your record deal, or things change, or circumstances change, and you sort of take the ride and you enjoy the ride, and then one day that particular part of the ride is over and you move on to something else. Is that fair?
That is very fair. Yeah. Very well put. Yeah.
And then so you went solo, you became a staff writer, I guess, for United Artists.
Yes.
And how was that?
That was fun.
Yeah.
You know, United Artists was a good company. I think I put out about three or four bands out of there. A band called Angel.
Yep.
Another band called Space Patrol. I can't even remember.
So but, different kind of job, different kind of pressure. Like, were you pressured to write hit songs? Were you still chasing hit songs?
Well, you're always chasing for hit songs.
Yeah.
But no, I was. There was no pressure at all there.
Okay.
There's. I mean, it was. It was just. It was a good company to work for, and I don't know. It was a good experience for me to sort of step back and get myself together again. And I did that, and United Artists gave me the opportunity to do that too.
Nice. Yeah, well, that sounds like it was good. And then you went solo, right? So you ended up getting a record deal with A&M in the early 80s, right? Is that right?
Yes. I don't know how that came about. I did, but no, I'm kidding. Michael Godin, he's out there, isn't he?
I have had him on the podcast. I met with him and talked to him, but I've had him on. Yeah, Michael's still, he's doing an oldies radio show now. He doesn't manage anymore, but Michael was the
right
guy. He was the A&R guy. Yeah. That's right.
Yes, he was at the time. Yeah. And it was fun, but you know, I could tell you a story, but you'd have to kind of clip it.
Well, go ahead. Shoot.
Are you sure? You want to hear it?
Sure.
Okay. I was not happy at A&M Records.
Okay.
And I guess one of the reasons was that they had decided that they didn't take my work seriously.
Hmm.
Let's put it that way, okay?
Okay.
And they were all cokeheads.
Okay.
So I walked in one day, and they were having their meeting, as they did every week, and I had a bag of cocaine. I threw it on the table. I said, "That's what you guys want and need."
Hmm.
And they all looked up. I mean, not one of them. You could tell they're all looking at it, this bag of cocaine. I said, "I don't want to stay here because I'm not happy here, and I'm not happy here because of you guys."
Hmm.
Anyway.
Yeah. So that
and that's when I walked out.
Okay. Well, it seems.
You know,
go ahead.
I don't want you to put that on unless you want to. You know?
Okay. Well, no, I appreciate that. I mean, that's an underside of the business that doesn't get mentioned very often. But that permeated much of the business, as we all know. It just doesn't get mentioned very often.
Yeah. But, I don't know why. I mean,
yeah,
you know.
I know.
Let's it was, be realistic here.
Absolutely.
I mean,
yep. And promoting was involved in that too, right?
Yes, very much so. I mean, you know, you have the true guys out there, like the Dave Marstons of the industry,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, and help people out.
You know, I was going to say, like, with you at A&M Records, I mean, you brought a lot to the table. You had already written hit songs. You'd had record deals. You had really a decent level of success. And you'd been a staff writer, so you weren't coming in there like some greenhorn that was begging for a record deal. You had a lot on the table already, right?
That's true. You know what? I don't know if that was important. They were tripping at the time.
Yeah, okay.
You know what I'm saying? It's like they weren't focusing, and they couldn't care less if I made it or not.
Right.
Because they were really too busy with Brian Adams at the time. I said, that's fine.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. You make a good point. They had just signed him and they were jumping all over him with Bruce Allen and promoting
they
him.
They were, exactly. Yeah. And I accepted that. I said, okay, that's fine. But like I said, they were tripping and it didn't matter because I couldn't wait to get away from that environment anyway.
So what did you do then? What did you do after that?
Well, what did I do? That was 83, 82. I moved here.
I moved
to California.
Moved to L.A.?
Yeah.
And that's where you're living now. You're still living there, right?
Oh, yeah.
You're still writing and recording and developing artists? You're still doing...
Yes. Okay. My the latest project I worked on was an EP called Bouquet en Pink.
Right. And that's available also through your website, jimmyb.com, right?
Yeah. But that's when the whole thing started. I decided I'm just going to get out of Canada. And it was good because I really like it here.
Yep.
And it's, I think I had a partner that I worked with here, and we decided we'll put our own label together.
Okay.
And put the stuff out. It's the internet now. I mean, anybody
That's right. Yeah.
You know, if they want. Anyway.
Yeah. So you're not beholden to anybody else too, right? You're kind of running. That's the one thing I've always wanted to be, is in charge of my own life and my own career. Like I miss the whole sort of, you know, coke and strippers thing and the whole living life on the road thing. I just could never have lived that life. I wasn't interested in that. So I wanted to be in charge of my own life. And it sounds like you've taken a similar path where you're the boss. You're driving the train of your life.
And you know what? It's something that everybody should do, I think. I don't have a lot of faith in people, you know. Mm. And like I said, at that time, when I was with A&M, they just, you know, I don't know what to say.
Yeah.
I wish I could, you know, I just don't know. It's just,
yeah.
They were idiots. And they're still idiots.
Yeah. Yeah, point taken. I mean, the whole record business, especially back then, but even probably now in some measure, but it's a bit of a dirty business. It's a bit of an exploitive business. They're trying to exploit you, you know, fairly or unfairly, but you're the meat puppet that's out there on the stage, and they're trying to make money off of you and ride you like a rented mule, as they say. And that whole part of the business is a little dirty.
Right? I like that. The rented mule. Very good, Dan.
Well... It's kind of true, right? I mean, that's my boy out there, and you're going to make me some money, and you're going to write songs that I want to hear, and you're like, okay, well, I'm a person too, right? I'm a human being.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I had that discussion with an agent one time. He said, well, you're just a commodity. I sell commodities. That's what I do. I said, no, I'm a person. I'm a human being.
Oh, yeah.
If you lose my humanity,
you know what?
I'm out.
I get, when you go through something like that, like you did, you know who you want to be with, and who you don't want to be with.
Yeah.
And it was the same here, because when I left A&M there, I came here and they wanted to talk to me, basically. And I just said to them, I said, listen, I don't like those guys up there. That's it.
Yeah.
It's that simple. Yeah. I just don't like them. And, you know, I went Dan, let's talk about something else.
Well, fair enough. But you know what? On a positive note, what I say now, my whole philosophy now is I just tell people, treat me like a friend. At this point in my life, I don't want to deal with sharks and barracudas and stuff. I just want to deal with my friends. I respect you as a person. You respect me. We work together to mutual benefit. We both make money. Everybody's happy. I'm good. And I treat you like a friend. And it's really worked out well for me, because the people I deal with, they get that. And I want a win-win situation. I'm not trying to exploit anybody, nor do I want to be exploited. And it all works out great. That's the way I fixed it, you know. So, so in 2004, you did an Abraham's Children reunion. Tell me about that.
Yes. Again, it was fun. We did, I believe we did the East Coast.
Yeah.
We started off doing that, and you know, it was fun. It was really fun. We had, I guess, maybe three of us. Well, there was only one original member in the band, but it was okay. It was, you know, it was fun. Again, I don't know. I don't know if I'm looking for that anymore. I mean, I don't want to play.
Right. Like play that, but, well, did it feel weird to go out and try to recapture what you, I guess it was already gone, like the magic from the time that you put out the original stuff, right?
Yes, it was. And, you know, it was okay, because, you know, I had really good players and, but it just wasn't, you know, I guess, you know, my drummer, Brian Cotterill, he was our drummer in Abraham's Children.
Yep.
He came to me one day and he said, you know what? It's not fun anymore.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
And that was it. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. No, that's a fair thing, because you're trying to recapture that energy that you had back then, but it's gone now, right? I mean, it's not
oh, yeah.
what it was, but But then, so fast forwarding to now, I listened to Turn Around on your site, and that's super, super nice and good vocals and harmonies and good production and stuff. So you still got some magic in you.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I'm having a lot more fun now.
Oh, good. You're still.
I'm fully still recording. Engaged. I'm just thinking. Yeah. We. I just started a new project. That's why.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of. Nice. I've got a new project going, and
good.
You know, I hope everybody goes to the site and just, or go to Spotify or whatever you, wherever.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, there's so many of them.
Yeah. So you did a collaboration with your daughter, is that right, Juliana? And you've recorded some songs, and you were the one I listened to, and she's done some poetry and whatnot. So you got a family involvement there?
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, she's an actress right now.
Okay. Yeah.
And she just they did a movie last year. I forget what it's called, but
nice.
She sings as well. She's a really good writer.
Nice.
And you know, she's motivated.
Yeah. Well, good.
So we work together on songs, and you know.
Well, that's nice. That's nice to see. I like the family thing, because I know so many guys that I know sacrifice their family on the altar of, you know, music and touring and all that stuff. And, you know, and you've seen it too, probably more than I have. And when you have a family and you're able to keep that together and your kids respect you and you can work together, that is heartwarming to me. So I wanted to mention that.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that, because, you know, I would do anything for her, and she knows that, but she's such a hard head that she says, no, Dad, I'm going to go and do it. I'm going to do it myself. Yeah. Like, okay. All right.
That's good.
Get grow some balls.
Well, it's often been said, you know, your kids are a bit of a mirror, right? You look at them and they mirror back to you. So that's good from that perspective. So the other question I had is, was there a message in your music? Like, you had obviously the Italian cultural message with that one song, but did you put any social or political messages in your music, especially back then with some of the protest songs and stuff? Was there any of that?
No.
Okay. Yeah, fair enough. Fair enough.
No. I can't say there is, because I as a writer try to sort of bring out the positive in anything that I do.
Yeah.
So if I start, you know, sending messages out there, you know, trying to be Neil Young or Bob Dylan, then that's not me.
Yeah.
No.
I
like the idea of being a pop writer.
Yeah. Yeah, fair enough. Feel good music, right?
Feel good music. I mean, it doesn't always have to be, you know, uplifting, but feel good music. Yeah, because there's just too much going on in the world right now.
Yeah,
you know, we've got wars going on.
That's a good point. I think back then, especially, there was anti-war songs, and then there was lots of peace songs, right? You know, the Summer of Love, and all through the 70s,
of course.
Lots of songs about, hey, let's be peaceful here. And those, so I just always ask the artists about that, because some people use their music as a vehicle to get those messages out. Others are just like, music is music, man. I just write songs that make people feel good, and that's all I care, you know, so.
You know, that's really true. I think that, well, if you listen to Bouquet on Pink, every one of the songs are basically tailored, if I can use that word.
Yep.
Yeah.
No,
but,
fair enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's, you know what? I'm sure I can write songs that, you know, will go against the establishment. I mean, I can do that too, but what's the point?
Yeah, fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. That's it. Okay, so next question. I see you were at the Dominic Troiano tribute. Did you know Dominic?
Yes.
Did you ever work with him? I had his brother Frank on the podcast.
I never worked with him. Yeah. I just loved Dom.
Oh, yeah.
I never worked with him, but he was a fine artist.
Yes, absolutely.
He was one of the best artists around.
Yeah. Nice.
It's sad, you know, but Dom is still appreciated.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had his brother Frank.
I hope I'm appreciated by him.
Yeah, you will be. You will be. Go on. But I had his brother Frank, because Frank Troiano wrote the book with another guy, and I had them on the podcast and got to talk to them about Dom's career and stuff. And he was an institution in Toronto for probably from the mid 60s right through till he passed away. So so I know I saw that. I just wondered if you ever met him or worked with him or had an association.
No, just I really respected him.
Yeah.
And that was the first benefit that we had for him, I think.
Nice.
Yeah. It was a nice event too. It was I think David Clayton Thomas was there.
Nice.
It was just a great event.
Okay, well, I'm glad you were.
I'm glad I was there.
Yeah, glad you were there too. That would say you needed to be included in that. And then so my next question is, how do you see the music scene now? You know, with recording and promoting, and like you said, it's open now with the internet, but it's also the Wild West, right? There's
gosh. Why do you guys ask these questions?
Because they're hard ones.
It is, yeah. You know what? I don't know where it's going. I know that, you know, I listen to Kiss FM, and I'm doing this for a reason. I listen to it on a daily basis. They play 6 songs, and that's it.
Yeah.
Every day. That's it. No wonder these people are wealthy.
Yeah. Well, there you go. Well, it's,
I'm telling you, it's like, you know, I can't believe the money these people are making these days,
but it's very few, right? I mean, the rest of us are just trying to get the songs out there. And, you know, I just did an album last year too, and you just get it out there on Spotify and try to find your way through the morass out there. There's just so much now. So how do you promote your stuff? Just on your website?
Pretty much. Yeah.
Yeah. And
yeah, you know what? I'm not looking to get rich.
Fair enough. Yeah.
From the internet. Yeah. I'm not. I mean, you know, if there's somebody that wants to go on there and they have a question for me, I'll answer the question. Right. If they want to buy a Time album, I'll send them a Time album.
Okay.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's like, it's okay. It's great.
Do you have the rights to the old Abraham's Children stuff? Do you get royalties off of that?
I do.
Oh, good for you. Oh,
I do.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. I went through a lot of hassle to get it because, through our manager, he died.
Right.
Jack died.
Yeah.
And, he had left his estate to his brother. And I just jumped on the brother and I said, look, you don't know nothing about these songs.
Yeah.
These are my songs. These are the songs that I wrote. And, anyway, he finally, I threatened to take him to court and he said, okay.
Yeah.
So I got him back.
Oh, good. Well, you know, it's a nice story because I know so many other people who weren't able to do that, you know, and like I knew Jerry Doucette up here, for example. He's passed away now, but he couldn't get his master tapes or any rights to his songs and stuff. And it just was, it creates a misery because you're looking at something that you want and can't have. And in some cases can never have,
you know, so. The unfortunate part is that it's not going to do the other person any good. Did you say Jerry Doucette?
Yeah. So he's passed away now, but...
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I remember talking to him about that, and he said, you know, he could have made way more money and done way better if he'd had control of his master tapes and his royalties, and he didn't, so...
Yeah, no, so. I understand that. I understand that. So, I mean, you know what? I'm just glad that I was able to do that.
Yeah, I'm happy for you, man. That trust me, I've heard the other story too many times. So when you said you were able to do that, I'm happy for you because those are great songs and they still have a place. And I hope that you still do well with them or as well as you can anyways in this modern age. So which leads
That's
to my
true.
My next question. How is AI, artificial intelligence, going to affect the music business, songwriting, producing, promoting?
Oh, it's gonna affect it just like anything else.
Yeah.
That comes along, you know, it will affect it. It will
help or hurt.
I think you know, everything is help.
Yeah,
definitely
in
help.
Some way. Yeah.
But, yeah.
But don't you think that the AI can write songs now and write lyrics and then you could take credit for the writing of that song?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Hmm.
Yeah, definitely. You know, it'll even play the instruments for you.
Yeah, there you go. And mix parameters. So you could pick.
That's right.
You know,
yeah, I mean, there's you don't need really need engineers anymore either.
I guess, you know, if the AI can do it.
Everything is just walk in the room and push a toggle switch and, yeah, and you got yourself a song.
Wow. Well, I mean, I guess that, I mean, the consumer's not going to care if they like the song, right? They'll just go, oh, I like that song.
No. Look, they don't care now.
Yeah.
And, you know, we go from, what, cassette tapes to burning CDs to, you know, streaming. It goes on and on. Someone will invent or keep inventing some other way to make things better and faster.
But then this is a little bit of a game changer in the sense that AI can scan the known melodies and then write unique melodies. So I've always asked the question, quite often asked songwriters, could there ever be another Beatles?
No.
I tend to agree with that. I always ask the question to see what people can say, but for a band to come out and change the musical landscape the way the Beatles did and then write so many memorable and impressive melodies and then produce them in the way that they did, I'm not sure that can ever be replicated. It's possible, but I just can't see it myself.
No, you're right. And I think one of the reasons, or maybe there's many reasons for that, is that the songs... Let me put it this way. There were other bands that tried to do what the Beatles did, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And weed them out. And some of them did really well because even the Beatles wrote songs for other people.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that to get 4 or 5 people with that headspace again...
Yeah.
Never going to happen.
Well, actually, you make an interesting point because I never thought of that, but you're right. There was other bands that tried to do what the Beatles did even at the time. So I was asking from now, could it ever be another Beatles now? But you, like you pointed out, there wasn't even another Beatles then. Some people tried, but they didn't do it.
And then there's some that are still trying to do it.
I guess, yeah.
I mean, realistically, I mean, you know, but... They're working, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. What can I say? Yeah. Well, tell me, what band were you with?
For me,
yeah.
Personally, well, I've just have a show band in Vancouver, so I've been a tribute artist now for the last 10 years doing Bob Seger and John Fogerty, and then I have an original project that never really took off the way that I wanted to, and then I've had a show band. I've had cover bands and show bands in Vancouver for the last over 40 years and made a good living, and I'm happy, and my wife still loves me, and my kids love me, and it's been a really, nice, really good life for me. I'm a very, very thankful person, and you know, realized early in my career that I was chasing a life I didn't actually want to live, because, you know, you want to make it. You want to make it somewhere. And I thought, well, what if make it somewhere? I'd be living a life I don't even want to live, because that wouldn't have worked for me. So everything worked out great for me. So I'm super thankful. So what would you do differently if you could do your career?
I wouldn't change anything. No.
Took it as it came and did what you thought you should do at the time?
You know, it was the moment. And the moment lasted for a couple of decades, and it's still there. So, no, I wouldn't do anything.
Okay, well, good. Well, I appreciate that. And I think that's a fair comment in the sense that, you know, people would often say, well, okay, if I had different sort of thinking at the time, I may have done something different. But given what I had at the time and my mindset, I made the decision I felt I should make. What good is it to regret that later? I mean, that's what I did. So,
that's true. I mean, I'm not, you know, I'm not chasing rainbows here at this point in my life, you know. It's like, let's just enjoy what we have.
No, I appreciate that. And if you're comfortable in your own skin and you feel pretty good about the way things worked out, that's because life is more important. I mean, we can talk music all we want, but life is more important than music. Music is an important part of life, but it's not life. You're happy where you're at in life?
I am.
Good for you.
I am happy.
Yeah. Nice to hear. Many thanks to my guest, Jimmy Bertucci, for being part of the Liner Notes podcast and sharing some insights from his many musical adventures and accomplishments. More information is available at jimmyb.com, and also for Abraham's Children is thechildrenrock.com. Lots of great information on both of those websites. We hope you enjoyed the podcast and invite you to subscribe to it and share it on social media so others can enjoy it as well. And we also invite you to listen to Dusty Discs Radio Tuesdays and Thursdays to hear music from the Canadian artists you're hearing on this show. So until next time, I'm Dan Harris.